Good evening. Senate Judiciary Committee will return from our recess from this afternoon. Our quorum continues to be present, and in fact, we have a quorum having checked in for this evening as well. And our first bill up is Senate File 460, Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not on the committee, so you'd have to move Senate File 460.
Well, why don't you go and explain it for us, and
sure.
Do you have an amendment that you want to put on it, Senator Hayden?
We do. We have the A4 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and this is not your first stop, is it?
This isn't. And
we can't do this as an author's amendment. So why don't you just tell us generally what the bill is about?
Sure.
And then we'll deal with the amendment. We'll have to have the amendment explained.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, we're going to deal with, for the purposes of your committee, Section 1, 18 through 28. Is that right, Mr. Hosh? 118, Section 1, Section 18 through 28, Section 33, 36, and 42. And I have Mr. Hosh from the department that will walk through your sections of the bill and also will explain the amendment.
All right. Just preliminarily, our council has prepared a memo. Members, that's in your folder, which identifies a slightly different listing of sections that are Judiciary Committee related. So we'll address all of them, Senator Hayden. We'll see if we can get them through the committee for you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate good. That.
Well, we'll take just the good ones, Senator Limmer.
I appreciate that, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Hosh, nice to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Larry Hosh. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Senate File 460 is a Children and Family Services policy bill. None of the provisions in this bill have a fiscal impact, and I will go through each of the sections that impact the items under the committee's jurisdiction. Section 1 expands access to child support data to relatives of the child that are interested in the permanency planning of the child. With that said, all privacy components still have to be complied by with federal law, and this just recognizes the realities that oftentimes it's more than just the parent that is interested in the permanency planning of that child. We will skip forward to the next section, Mr. Chair, and this is a section I don't think is in your brief from Senate Counsel. This deals with the Injury Protection Program in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. The Minnesota Family Investment Program requires participants to focus on work and job placement. The Injury Protection Program is essentially a workman's comp program. So if a county places an individual in a work experience program, if that person were to get injured or hurt, the counties are protected and are able to meet the costs associated with that placement. We update terminology in the Injury Protection Program to clarify throughout statute that work experience programs is the common terminology. We also update for consistency matter, instead of having things such as referring to a tribe or a tribal member, everything is consistent as tribe. There's no substantive changes. It's just more for clarity's sake. A little background on the Injury Protection Program. There was one claim last year for $53. However, it's important to make sure that we have consistency in statute for protection and confidence in the program for when counties place participants. The next section will be Section 36. This is in the Senate Council memo that you received. And Section 36 removes the requirement to immediately file a termination of parental rights when there is a person that is required to register as a sex offender. This is part of department language that occurred from the last legislative session. Clauses 5 and 6 were added into statute. Clause 5 was the intended purpose that if a child were to ever have an act portrayed upon them, that of immediate termination of parental rights would have to be filed. However, Clause 6 went beyond their original intention. The counties came to us with their concerns that this was overreaching, and it could include many people that years and years ago may have had to file and didn't necessarily protect the child in that household. So at the request of the county attorneys and with their support, we're trying to fix some of the department language that passed last year. Section 37 is for if somebody requests a do not resuscitate or do not intubate order for a child under the jurisdiction of the commissioner, that commissioner can set up protocols for that DNR or DNI request, and also consult with an ethics expert and also provide protections to that ethics expert for the recommendations that they provide to the commissioner. Section 38 deals with expanded trial home visits for voluntary foster care. This allows for a six-month window to try to allow for a trial home visit for a person under voluntary foster care. Many of these individuals are people with are children with disabilities. Section 39 aligns with Section 36 and is a part of the overreaching nature when it comes to the registered sex offender issue and the immediacy for having to file a termination of parental rights. Sections 39 through 42 deal with recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Last year, the OLA submitted a report with recommendations for child protection screenings. Section 39 clarifies what constitutes as a report and aligns with the federal definition of report versus a referral. A report is something that is beyond a referral. A referral is the entrance into the agency. A report is once it's been screened into the system. Section 40 clarifies how a screened out report can be used for purposes of the department. Section 41.
What's the change there, Mr. Hosh? It clarifies how it can be used.
We add language, and this aligns with the recommendations of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And let me. And if you look, Mr. Chair, on 41.26, it clarifies that a screened out report must not be used for any purpose other than making an offer of social services to the subjects of the screened out report.
And what is a screened out report?
If the report hasn't been substantiated for child maltreatment, so oftentimes, and we do have people from the department, so if I err on my response, there'll be a family assessment, and after the family if the report substantiates that services need to be provided for the protection of the child, then that report is considered screened in. So a screened out.
So this is a term of art within the work that the agency does, and if there's been if the investigation concludes that the report was validated, I guess, then it's considered screened in.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a finding that they can't validate the then it's considered screened out. And then you're limiting the use of that screened out report. Is that it?
Mr. Chair, we have an expert here that will be able to answer that much more gracefully than I.
Thank you. Ma'am, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Ann Alstrom for the Department of Human Services. The term, you are correct, it is a term of art within child protection. The term screened in or screened out means what was received, the information received by the agency did not meet the statutory definition of child maltreatment. So the person making the phone call or writing the letter didn't put enough in to indicate that the child was actually maltreated. Mr. I know Mr. Hush, went one step further into the work that the agency does actually after it's screened in.
Okay. And this limits the use of the report that's screened out to simply an offer of social services to the subjects. Is that it?
Correct.
Thank you. Mr. Hosh, go ahead and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Section 41 deals with clarifying the retention period for a report. In that retention period, the clock starts ticking, will essentially start ticking when the final entry in that report is made. Section 42 clarifies that a report must be accepted when submitted by a reporter, and that's the very last section of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Be accepted. So the point here is, even if the reporter refuses to provide their name and address, and they somehow wish to remain anonymous, is that the idea? You still want the ability to accept the report?
Mr. Chair, that is the intent, and this also follows the OLA's recommendation to provide consistency for and clarity in the process for accepting a report.
Okay. Are there any? Could you review once again for us Section 1 that expands the access to the child support data? Who gets access now, and to whom are you expanding that access?
Mr. Chair, and this is actually part of the A4 amendment also, where family is replaced with relatives of the child to provide clarity exactly who this would be affecting. And this just allows for the sharing of child support data with relatives of a child who are interested in the permanency planning of that child. They still have to comply and be in accordance with all federal law.
So you're deleting on lines 5.29 to 0.32, you're deleting limitations on the use or disclosure of that data. What's the purpose of that deletion? Or is that changed in your amendment?
Mr. Chairman, the change actually permits the Child Protection Agency to access child support data in regard to the identity, location, whereabouts, if you will, of the child's parents, and their relatives. This legislature requires Child Protection to do relative searches when children go into foster care, which is the time they're at risk for permanent placement away from their relatives, and that is the time that permanency planning commences. The language that is deleted makes sure that Child Protection can use that data for purposes appropriate to planning for the child, engaging the relatives in case planning, providing, have the relatives provide other supports during the period of time the child is in foster care.
So you just want to make sure that you're not somehow going a bit beyond the scope of the statute when you're using the data?
Mm-hmm. We want to stay within the scope of the statute, but we want to be able to make sure that if one part of the agency knows about relatives and the family of the child, the other part, Child Protection, if you will, also has access to that data. So it's the 4D and 4E local agencies work that can work together with the way this is modified.
Are there any questions from members of the committee at this point? Mr. Hosh, why don't you explain the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The amendment, the first part of the amendment addresses what I just spoke of, is clarifying the broadness. There was some concern in the last committee with the broadness of the term family, and we clarified that with relatives of the child. Section 1.5 and also, or line 1.5, just changes an effective date to immediately following final enactment. That is also on line 1.23 and 1.25. If you take a look at the new language that's added, this is dealing with do not resuscitate and do not intubate issue. This was suggestions by Senate Council to provide clarity in our intention. It doesn't change the scope or the intent of the language as you see in the current first engrossment.
Yeah, Ms. Pontius, the language that's in the A4 amendment, lines 11 through 21, is that your rewrite then?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. It was a little confusing the way it was drafted, and it didn't quite track grammatically, so I tried to break it down a little bit. But basically, all the substantive language is the same.
Okay, so, Mr. Hosh, could you give us a little more detail, please, on exactly what is being added to the statute then in that provision?
Well, it's
FCNC.
Sure. It's providing for a protocol when an agency does request that there be a physician's order for a DNR or DNI, do not resuscitate, do not intubate. It allows for procedures for the commissioner to request consultation when contemplating that request for an order. It also allows the commissioner to consult an ethics expert during that consultation. And then after that, it also provides the hospital or the ethics, the person who provides the ethics consultation, some immunity from criminal liability or civil liability for that consultation.
And that immunity, is that an entirely new provision in statute in this area?
Mr. Chair, within the subdivision, yes.
Are there any comparable immunity provisions that you know of in the human services area? Perhaps our other testifier would have?
Mr. Chairman, in regard to reporting of child maltreatment, there is immunity that's provided for reporters. The idea was to encourage the report. Years and years ago when it first passed, to encourage the reporting of child abuse and neglect, and so people didn't have to be afraid that they would be sued or that if they were sued, they would have immunity. This is for a population of children who are under state guardianship, so they have no parents. The one that is making the decision on behalf of the child is the Commissioner of Human Services, who wants to consult with people and get their honest opinions about what should happen in regard to end-of-life care for this particular child. The practitioners who interact with the commissioner have requested that they be assured they don't have any liability for giving their honest opinion about what should happen to this medically fragile child.
Counsel's pointing out to me online. 1.21 of the amendment, that they only get the immunity if they act in good faith and in accordance with the applicable medical standards of care. That's actually an interesting combination, because basically there's no liability if you're acting within the standards of care anyway. Negligence, by definition, is acting below the standard of care. So does this... I guess I could ask the question, does this have the effect that you desire it to have?
If it's duplicative. No. Mr. Chair, we certainly want physicians and professionals, the commissioner's consulting, to act within the standard of care. That's why that language is in there.
We need to adopt the amendment also. So, Senator Limmer.
Well, Mr. Chair, could someone tell me what the applicable medical standards of care would be? Is there a big book somewhere that someone refers to, or what would that be?
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Hosh.
Senator Limmer, at this point, I don't have a reference to a specific applicable standards of care. That's something we can definitely look into and get back to you on. But nothing at my fingertips.
Mr. Chair, I thought the word standard might have given us a hint that there might be some reference. So I'm not quite sure what I'm voting on here if I don't know what that is.
Senator Limmer's standards is used generally, whether there's a book or not. Sometimes it's used in court where you have an expert comes in and says, this is the standard of care, and so didn't meet it. And they may refer to medical textbooks. They may refer to all sorts of different reference sources or just their professional opinion.
Mr. Chair, is there ever a difference of opinion by professionals what standard of care is?
That's the stuff of trials, Senator Limmer.
The other question I had, Mr. Chair, is on line 13, where there's a reference to submitting the request according to procedures established by the commissioner. Does that change with commissioners, or is that a standard? Oh, there's that word again, but is there a reference that one commissioner to another would keep a continuity of the procedure involved?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I do know I've been working for the department for 15 years, and the procedures have only improved over time. They've been basically the same, except I would say the only thing that varies is the actual involvement of the commissioner in the particular decision of the particular child, but the procedures are the same.
Okay. Members, what we're going to do, Senator Hayden has a roll call on pensions right now, apparently, so we're going to lay this bill on the table, and we'll come back to it when Senator Hayden returns.
Okay. I'll run right up. I'll be right back.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, we'll make good use of our time. Senator Wicklund here. Senator Wicklund, come on forward. Senate File 832, Bond Security Requirements Modification.
That's her first.
And Senator Limmer is reminding me that this is Senator Wicklund's first time appearing before the Judiciary Committee.
It is, yes.
Ooh.
Good evening.
Brought brownies.
What's that?
Yeah.
Donuts,
brownies.
Oh.
The ante's getting higher.
They're
and
in
higher.
My office.
He's sorry. We'll wait.
We lay the bill over. Until we... Senator
Wicklund. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know the protocol. Sorry.
Why don't you go ahead and explain your bill, Senator?
Thank you. I'm here tonight to present Senate File Number 832. This is a bill that it is a technical change to remove an archaic requirement enacted in 1905. And Ken Allen is here tonight from the Department of Administration to talk about the change and what's involved. So I will turn it to him.
Mr. Allen, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division in the Department of Administration. As the Senator stated, the language that we're asking you to remove is dates from 1905. And at the time, the requirement was, until today, the requirement is to have two sureties for a performance bond issued in the state of Minnesota, and that each of those sureties must be a resident of the state and a freeholder of the state, which means a property owner in the state of Minnesota. What we're asking you to change is eliminating the requirement for there to be two sureties and for those individuals to be residents and property owners. The original language was literally passed 108 years ago, and I was looking to see if there were cars or horses or what exactly was the status of transportation then. The language really does predate the existence of automobiles, so at the time it probably made sense to require that you could reach the surety on your horse. But obviously almost every part of our economic and business world has changed since 1905, and now the primary providers of surety bonds are large insurance companies. So in light of the changes in business and technology, the language really is obsolete. It got kind of lost in the statutes over the years, and someone discovered it a few years ago. called it to our attention. It's relevant to the Department of Administration because there are other statutes that require us to use surety bonds that relates to our construction vendors. So if we were, in fact, to truly enforce the language in this in the statute, it would be extremely burdensome for businesses. They'd be required to have two sureties rather than one. The change is supported by both the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Commerce, and I appreciate your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair.
So, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, on 1.12, it talked about freeholders to be residents and freeholders of the state. I'm assuming that's because, you know, the transportation in the old days wasn't as good. Were there other reasons for that that I'm not noticing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I'd only be speculating. I mean, the people that passed the law aren't around to tell us exactly what they were thinking. But it doesn't make sense okay. now. And it would truly be a huge burden on the businesses that are required to produce surety bonds.
Sure.
Senator Hall, the one member of the Senate that was around at the time, Senator
Cohen,
is
Limmer?
Not present here. But I'm told Senator Limmer was in the House at the time.
Oh. Yeah, me and the Freeholder Caucus.
You were a lucky man, Senator Limmer. Probably had to be a man at the time, too, come to think of it.
That's right.
All right, are there any further questions or discussion? Senator Hall moves
832.
That Senate File 832 be recommended to pass. And I know there's a request for the consent calendar, but we've been informed that we are to send everything to general orders. And
really?
And so we're not going to be doing much in the way of consent calendars this year.
Okay. Senator Limmer, we respect your right to beat it up.
What's that?
We respect your right to beat up our bills.
I don't.
Right. So the motion is to recommend it to pass and send it on to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Dreaded judiciary.
All right. Senator Wicklund, you have another bill.
I do.
Before us. Now, since this is your second bill before the committee, Senator Limmer is admonished not to be too hard on you this time.
Oh, good. All right.
Senate File 516, Contested Case Judicial Review Service.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I am here to present Senate File Number 516. This is a bill that has to do with requiring petitions appealing a final decision of an agency in a contested case that it must be served on all parties to the contested case. And tonight we have Judge Ann O'Neill here to kind of go through the reasoning for this change to the statute. So I will let her present.
Judge, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'm Ann O'Reilly. I'm an administrative law judge for the Office of Administrative Hearings. No problem. We also have an Ann Marie O'Neill, so I'm frequently confused with her. But basically, this is a very simple change that that we're requesting here to Minnesota Statute Section 14.63. It's changing the word "the agency," replacing that with "all parties to the contested case." And the reason for that is basically the way that the rule is written, the way that the law is written at this time, final decisions that are issued by our office, if they are appealed to the Court of Appeals, we're brought in as a party to that appeal. We're served and we're joined as a party. Before you, I think you should have a color copy that looks like this. And this will help to illustrate the two general types of decisions our office makes. The Office of Administrative Hearings has two different types of case decisions that they make. The first, and 90% of our cases, are recommendations. We have a referral from agency, from state agencies. We work with about 120 state agencies, and when cases are directed to us, they are for hearing. We provide a neutral and independent hearing, and what we do findings of fact, conclusions, and recommendations. Those recommendations are not final decisions. The recommendation then is sent to the agency head. And the agency head, the commissioner, or the head of that agency, the people who you see here on the right side of the page, are the ones who would make the final decision. That's about 90% of our cases. In about 10% of the cases, the ALJ will make a final decision. For example, citations issued by OSHA, sex offender registration cases. In that 10% of the cases, when we issue a final decision, when that is appealed, so the aggrieved party, the party who is unhappy with the decision then, goes to the Court of Appeals, petitions for a writ of certiorari to the Court of Appeals. The rule says that they must serve the agency. It says it must serve the agency. Well, we're the agency making the final decision, but we don't have a horse in that race, you see. We're just the tribunal, which is holding the hearing. But we're still brought in as a party then to that appeal. And by changing it to all parties to the contested case, then that would just bring in the actual parties of interest. That would be the party who is aggrieved, as well as the agency that actually is involved in the policymaking aspect of it. Currently, we get served with it. We're brought in as a party to the appeal, and we have to get our attorney and attorney general then to submit something to the Court of Appeals saying, we're not submitting anything, we take no position. Our position is to provide a fair hearing and to apply the law. So our interest would be that the Court of Appeals then reviews it for the correct application of the law, but we have no interest. We do not have a position with respect to the underlying issues. So we would never be in a position to, say, appeal it to the Supreme Court. And it just costs us money, and it's also confusing to the parties who are then serving the appeal. So we're just asking that you clean it up and change the agency to all parties to the contested case to make it clear as to who the parties of interest in the appeal are. Happy to answer any questions. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Judge. Sure. Any questions, Senator Limerick?
I do. By making this choice to all parties, and we're going to be serving them, is there going to be an extra cost as we multiply the impact of serving these filings? Is there an extra cost? Does it multiply the
Actually, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It should actually reduce it because it wouldn't, all parties to the contested would be the underlying action. So the underlying, let me give an example. For example, if you're appealing a final decision on an OSHA matter, that's brought by the Department of Labor and Industry. So the underlying parties to that action would be the Department of Labor and Industry, and the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and the party, let's say, Corporation ABC, ABC Corporation. Those would be the parties to the contested case hearing. Now, we make a final decision in that. So under the current law, OAH would be brought in as an additional agency and party to the appeal. We have no... we take no position with respect to the underlying issues. And so we have no policy interest, if you will. So it's actually reducing the parties, even though the word says all parties as opposed to just the agency. It would be actually, in effect, reducing the number of parties who actually get served. It's the original parties to the suit. to the matter, I should say.
Senator Hall, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Your Honor.
Thank you. You
said never a couple times. Would you then never, in the new way of doing it, or in the, are you never a part of one of the parties?
We should not
in,
be,
in
no.
any way.
No, we are the tribunal that we offer an independent hearing. And also the reason, one of the other benefits of the change is that it increases our independence. The importance of the OAH is that we be an independent agency. We're not related in any way to the agency that brought the action. Therefore, we can make a we are neutral decision makers. We're not beholden to any interest, and we have no policy interests, if you will.
Okay. Mr. Chair, follow up.
Your
Honor, can you tell me then, do you understand why they originally had the agency? Any idea?
I think it was just it was just a simple way of meaning for the 90% of the cases, it is the agency. It's pretty simple because the agency is making the final decision. So it was probably neglecting the 10% where our office is actually making the final decision. So it's not actually our agency's. We're not, although we're issuing the final decision like a court would be, we're not the party bringing the action, if you will, the enforcement action.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
I don't quite understand it all, but I trust her.
I don't know if I failed or in my explanation then, and I apologize if I can.
Senator Hall, I think they're inserting language in there now that will cover both agencies and in that 10% of the cases where it's not the agency as a party, the other parties. So the language is broad enough now to cover all the circumstances.
That works.
All right. Did I say that correctly, Judge?
Yes, you did, and I apologize if I wasn't clear.
Not at all. Are there any other questions?
Don't ever admit that on a microphone.
Senator Wicklund. Someone must have a hard question for Senator Wicklund on the first appearance here.
No. Just wasn't.
First time?
For this committee, yes.
Senator Limmer?
This intimidating.
You know, we're not living up
I'm
to our
always,
reputation.
I'm always made out to be the bad guy on this committee.
Well, Mr. Chair?
I'll make the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall had something.
I was just going to see if Senator Wicklund would like to explain the bill.
Thank you, Senator Hall, for that opportunity. I think she did a very good job.
I think
job.
So, yes.
All right, Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 516 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, Senator Hayden has returned to the room.
Uh-oh.
Thank you, Chair and Committee, for your indulgence.
No problem, Senator Hayden. All right, so we were going to take up, I believe, your amendment momentarily. But let's see if there were any other questions before we took that step. I think Senator Limmer had inquired about standards of care. Had you finished your line of questioning, Senator Limmer?
The question I had was on the, not necessarily the standard of care, and I don't have an amendment in front of me right now, but the...
It's the A4 amendment.
It was the line above. I think it was on line 12, if my memory serves me right. The commissioner's standard procedure of what was referred to, and could you explain to me what we were talking about in the event that there's different commissioners, does the standard remain the same or does it change as a commissioner changes?
Mr. Hosh.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, under the current language that procedure is established by the commissioner, so it could generally changed by the commissioner. From my understanding, when procedures are established for how an agency can submit a request, generally those procedures may be modified in order to modernize how those procedures are done, make sure that it's more agency or consumer friendly. But I, from my understanding, those procedures don't change substantially. And if they do change, they change for the better when taking an input for.
Mr. Chair, is this the same bill that had the immunity from liability for the commissioner?
Yes, that's also in the A4 amendment.
And is that already in existence as a current standard that we go by? Is there an immunity from liability?
Not for the commissioner. It's for the ethics. Those who are providing ethics consultation.
Okay. And is that something new?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, this is new language. So for following the procedure for providing ethics consultation at the request of the commissioner, that is new language. The previous discussion was, does the current definition of standards of care already provide immunity? We may be duplicative with this language with the standards of care, but would rather be safe than sorry and make sure that the avenues are there for the commissioner to get a proper consultation from an ethics expert when you're dealing with something as serious as a DNR or DNI.
Are there any further questions? Senator Goodwin, would you like to move the
yes.
A4 amendment?
Yes, I move the amendment, the
A4 amendment.
All right, A4 amendment.
Senator Goodwin moves the adoption of the A4 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further questions or discussion on Senate File 460? Seeing none, Senator Goodwin moves the adoption of Senate File 460 as amended. Let it be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Hayden, nice work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hosh had to leave the House of Representatives to be allowed to testify in front of the Senate.
As it should be.
Enjoyed every moment.
Yes.
Okay. I'll ask you.
All right, now we'll take up Senator Hall's bill. Senate File 1002. Senator Hall, is this your first appearance before the Senate?
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, you brought treats, Senator Limmer?
I asked Limmer to bring them. Senator Limmer said he would be kind enough to do that.
Bring what?
All right. Senator Hall, why don't you explain your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You coming in here, Kevin? This bill, Senate File 1002, is a bill brought to me by the Public Defender's Office, and I have with me here the Chief Administrator, Kevin Kyer, and the Chief Information Officer, Bob Sikora.
Yeah, close.
Good enough?
Yeah.
And the bill is giving the public defenders the same access to some information as the prosecutors have. And I'm going to let these two guys explain that a little bit more. Thank you.
Mr. Sikora, are you the first one on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this is an opportunity to bring the statute up to speed with how criminal law is practiced by our public defenders and prosecutors in criminal courts across Minnesota. Rather than the defender asking the prosecutor for information about jail booking data regarding witnesses, prosecutors have just been telling our defenders, go get it yourself. It's available to you online using the Department of Corrections database. So what this does is bring the statute up to speed with that change in the practice of law.
We have distributed... are distributing an A1 amendment. I understand this is to be an author's amendment. Is that correct, Senator Hall?
That is correct.
I'm willing to offer that now if you'd like.
Yes, that's been the first stop. We'll go ahead and adopt that. Senator Hall moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further presentation in connection with the reasons for the bill? Maybe explain the amendment as well.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment is suggested by the Department of Corrections, and it puts into the language of Chapter 241.065, which is the Department of Corrections language, an audit requirement, which is a common sense way of handling such expansions of data access. We expand the access. We send our auditors around checking to make sure that people are using it in accordance with the statute. The DOC suggested that. We totally support the idea.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, could I direct you to your amendment on line 7, where it says the Department of Corrections may establish. Is that the word you want to use, may, or do you want something more definite like the word shall or must?
Yeah.
Do you know why may is included? It seems like it's an option for the department.
What?
Yeah.
You guys
okay?
Sure.
I'm okay.
Sure. Yeah. I'd like to amend the amendment and strike out the may and add after the corrections shall. Good catch there, Senator Limmer.
All right, Senator Hall moves that line 1.7 of the A1 amendment, already adopted, shall be amended to delete may and insert in its place shall. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further questions or discussion?
Is this his first bill?
No. That question has been asked, Chair.
Senator Hall is trying to avoid responsibility.
I don't Senator think he Sharon. Answered the question.
Yes, in that case. Senator.
Senator Sharon.
Senator Hall.
I've always liked you.
I would just like to know if you have any aliases or known monikers.
I'm afraid you'd use that against me. Thank you.
Senator Hall deftly deflects the question. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 1002?
Should we raise the question of tattoos?
No. Hopefully they're not part of the database.
Let's just keep moving on.
So Senator Hall moves that Senate File 1002 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. That was good. Thank you, members.
Senator Hall. Senator Goodwin, Senate File 650.
Just in case you just
Senator Goodwin, I'm informed that the agency may not be here right now.
Testifying
on your House counterpart.
This last one.
Well, why don't you consult? The agency magically appeared.
We're here.
How did you get here from the House so fast? That was good.
We're split up. We're all over the place.
A big agency.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you.
Senate File 650, your bill.
Senate File 650 is a technical bill from the Department of Commerce. They are making some changes to the name of their fraud investigation unit and other changes. This bill went before Commerce Committee, and it did have some controversial provisions in it at that time, which we took out, and I've been totally assured that this has nothing controversial in it now. So we do have an amendment, though, to get the bill in the shape that I'd like it in, and that's the A2 amendment. I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Senator Goodwin, this is your second stop on this bill, so
correct.
Please explain the A2 amendment to us.
Yeah, actually, I would like the department to do that because it's new to me.
Allison Grebner with the Department of Commerce. The A2 was brought to us by the Department of Public Safety. It came to our attention that how the language was originally worded wouldn't quite work for the feds, and so apparently DPS has been informed that this language would work best. So it's purely a technical change is what we've been told.
Ms. Pontius, have you seen this before, the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, that Mr. Backus drafted that.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's my understanding. It's come from the BCA just to make the background check language work better.
Okay, there's some deletions there as well. They're deleting the existing language and replacing it with the new language here.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right, Senator Goodwin moves the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Goodwin, I'm informed there's an A3 amendment. Have you seen it yet?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, what did you ask me?
There's an A3 amendment, which Ms. Pontius.
We don't know about that one.
It was drafted at 10 to 6, so.
Well, then that's why we don't know about that one.
Okay, well, let's get a copy of this amendment to the testifiers. Ms. Pontius, why don't you go ahead and explain the amendment?
Mr. Chairman and members, it just deals with the data provisions that are in the bill. If the first part adds a cross-reference in the Data Practices Act, which you always do whenever there's a data classification. And the second part, if you look at page 6, and this is based on a model act, so a lot of the language doesn't quite track what we normally use in the Data Practices Act. So it just changes a reference where it talks about these actuarial reports being confidential by law and privileged. It just says they're confidential data on individuals or protected non-public data as defined in Section 13.02. So it just brings them into our terminology.
Mr. Chair, whose amendment is this?
Sound a good one?
It's Pardon? Mine.
So whose amendment?
Oh, wait a minute. It's mine. More
this
and more surprises.
This will be your amendment, Senator Goodwin, but maybe the two testifiers that are with you can opine on whether it's acceptable.
Mr. Chair, Peter Brickwoody, Department Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Our apologies to both our author and to the committee. Our Department of Public Safety, our counterparts, late yesterday informed us that we needed the technical correction contained in the amendment in order to make the background checks contained in the federal conformity with appraiser licensing section of the bill work for the federal government.
Mr. Brickwoody, I think that was the A2 amendment we adopted as you walked into the room. We're now doing the A3 amendment dealing with actuarial data.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair. This is the first I've seen of the A3 amendment.
Yes.
Why
don't you take a moment to look at that, and we'll work our way through other aspects of the bill before we consider that amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, nobody seems to be claiming this amendment, so I don't know whose it is. It's not the department's amendment.
I saw the problem in a bill. I contacted the Department of Administration, the Information Policy Analysis Division. I know they had some conversations Stacey Christensen did with some people in the department, and I can't remember the names now. They're in my emails back in my office. But they were fine with making this little bit of a change as long as it didn't totally rewrite the whole confidentiality section of the bill. So,
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It all came together at the last minute today.
All right. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as long as our council, Senate Council, Ms. Pontius decided it was necessary to make the language in the shape it should be, and then I will offer this A3 amendment as well.
So, Senator Goodwin, are you okay with the A3 amendment?
Yes, I am, and I'll offer it.
Senator Goodwin moves the A3 amendment's adoption. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Senator Goodwin, will you or one of your testifiers take us through the provisions in the bill that relate to the Judiciary Committee?
Yes, I'll allow the department to describe the technical changes they want.
Mr. Chair, apologies for my tardiness. The bill is also up in the House Commerce Committee simultaneously. So,
Brickwood, you have mastered appearing in two places at once. Congratulations.
thank you, Senator.
Show us how some of it.
Mr. Chairman, the bill has come before the Judiciary Committee for a couple of items. One was related to the A2 amendment, the appraiser licensing federal conformity, which contains background checks as part of it. I don't believe controversial, but there is background checks, including fingerprinting for appraisers who will be who are currently licensed by the Department of Commerce. And so that's point one. Number two are the provisions related to the Insurance Fraud Division. Two provisions, and we have the director of the Insurance Fraud Division, Bob Hearns, here with me, who can answer any specific questions. One is providing access for the Insurance Fraud Division to the Cybers database, which is a criminal database, which was created prior to the creation of the Insurance Fraud Division, which is the statute lists out the law enforcement agencies that currently have access to the Cybers database, and because it didn't exist at the time when Cybers was created, Insurance Fraud Division is not listed as one of them, and so we would like to add the Insurance Fraud Division to that list of law enforcement bodies that have access to the database. Additionally, there are provisions in the bill related to the Insurance Fraud Division's subpoena powers, which also brings the bill before the committee.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I got a question.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of missed it in your description. Who are you collecting fingerprints from?
Mr. Brickley.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the department's bill amends Chapter 82B to conform with new federal requirements for real estate appraisers. Applicants, if the bill were to pass, applicants would be required to undergo a background check, which includes fingerprinting. The proposal would take effect on January 1 of 2015. So there would be a fee that folks would pay for that background check, and which we would then turn over to either the FBI or the BCA to perform the background check. And it is part of a conformity with federal changes that were made, and I am aware of no opposition to the changes that we have in our bill at the moment.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Why are appraisers singled out by the federal government to collect fingerprints on them in order to do their job?
Mr. Brickwood, if you know the reasons behind the federal government action.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I do not have the specific background for why the changes were made at the federal level. I'd be happy to provide that to you from staff tomorrow in the morning if you would like.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
what would happen in the event that the state would refuse the federal request? What would happen?
Mr. Brickley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I believe we would certainly, A, be out of conformity with federal law, and B, I think we would quickly find ourselves out of sync with the rest of the country in terms of what our procedures are for real estate appraisers in this area. Again, I'm not aware of any opposition to these conformity provisions, and I think we would find ourselves with a different set of operations than other states in an area where we strive for uniformity across the entire country.
The other question I had, Mr. Chair, was on Section 2. This is in regards to subpoena authority, and we're restricting an individual not to even disclose there is or was a subpoena issued. Why is that in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I would
that seems unusual.
Ask the Director of our Insurance Fraud Division, Mr. Hearns, to...
Robert Hearns, Director of the Division of Insurance Fraud Prevention at the Department of Commerce.
Welcome, Mr. Hearns.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, our division conducts criminal investigations into insurance fraud across the state of Minnesota, and as a part of that, we frequently utilize subpoenas to obtain information from financial institutions, and as we go about conducting our investigation, having the financial institution disclose the fact that we're requesting information regarding their bank accounts can, as you might imagine, have a negative impact on our investigations.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's referring to the information that may be disclosed, but to disclose that a subpoena was even created to prevent someone from even disclosing whether even is a subpoena, that to me is a little different. Is that a common practice?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the only thing I can tell you is that if a subject of a criminal investigation becomes aware that a criminal investigation agency at the Department of Commerce is requesting their bank records, that obviously might tune them into the fact that we are conducting an investigation and might lead to destruction of other evidence which could hamper our investigation.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I would add that I think the change that we are proposing here would make the division's subpoenas consistent with those with administrative subpoenas that are issued by county attorneys across Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, is Section 2, the request regarding the subpoenas, is that a federal request as well as the other one?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, no, it is not.
Are there any other questions regarding this bill?
Mr. Chair, maybe
Senator Limmer,
maybe counsel can help me here. Under data practice provisions, even if someone was under a criminal investigation, that file that's created by, let's say, a police department, that would be considered a confidential file. But the subject of the file could go to the Department of Police and say, are you investigating me? Or do you have a file on me? And isn't it true that they would have to disclose at least that amount, not the details of the investigation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I think all they would have to disclose is that they have data, confidential data on you.
All right.
But beyond that, they wouldn't have to say it's part of an investigation. I said that, so you do know that there, the existence of the data.
And
but
Mr.
Not
and Mr. Chair details. And Counsel, Ms. Pontius, does that run into a conflict with the subpoena language that we have here?
Ms. Pontius.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, this is directed at the private person who gets a subpoena, so it's different.
Receives a subpoena.
Right.
So all right.
Senator Hall.
On that point, getting a subpoena, I assume that's from a judge and it's for good cause.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, this is a provision in state statute that gives the commissioner subpoena power for certain records, so it is not reviewed by a judge. They're issued by the Department of Commerce.
To that point, the commissioner then would have to have good cause to do that?
Mr. Harms.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall, we don't issue subpoenas unless we have reasonable suspicion that a crime has been committed that would initiate our investigation.
Okay.
Are there any further questions? Any further information to present, Senator Goodwin?
Not to my knowledge. Nobody else is asked to testify. So I would move that Senate File 650 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
As amended. Seeing no further discussion, Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 650 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Did you want me to do my next bill, Mr. Chair?
Let's see here.
Thank you.
You were there?
744?
Sure. Let's go ahead and do 744.
Excellent.
While you're there.
We have a number of students here from University of Minnesota, and I'm just sure they want to go home and go to bed or study. So.
Oh, yeah.
I thought they were here for a poli-sci class.
Okay, Mr. Chair, first
Senate
I'd like
file
to...
File 744.
744, and I would like to, let's see, my testifiers. You have that sheet, Mr. share my
yes, we have,
list of testifiers.
On the list, Matt Forstey, Taylor Williams, Dan Drill Mellum, and Elizabeth Hibsch.
Hibsch. Yeah, it's not like it looks.
Okay. Is everybody here?
Matt just stepped out.
Okay.
And so.
Mr. Chair, our other testifier will be here shortly. In the meantime, I just want to go over a few things. I wish this is probably one of my top favorite bills that I'm carrying this session because I think it's really it's a creative thought that I can't take credit for. It was really put together by the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition at the University of Minnesota, and it's a very thoughtful approach to helping young people that are minors that are drinking. Currently, if a minor is in a position where they're very ill from drinking, if they're very afraid to go in and get help either at a health care center or at in a treatment facility or whatever because they're afraid they're going to be charged with underage consumption, this bill would say that not only for them but for people that call an emergency situations, and report that another person is in need of medical assistance, that they won't get charged with underage consumption. And the reasons I think this is really important is because, you know, no matter what happens, we all know that minors are going to have alcohol parties, and we'd love to stop them, and we're not doing this to encourage them in any way, shape, or form, and in fact, I don't think it will. But what we want to do is save young people's lives and hopefully get them into treatment when they need it, and sometimes the only time they're willing to go into treatment is when they're heavily intoxicated. So I would like the students here to explain how they got to this and why they decided that this needed to be done and how they brought it to the legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please state your name and go ahead and give us your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Forstey. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota, and I serve as the chair of the Minnesota Student Legislative Coalition, which is the organization that represents students throughout the University of Minnesota system, so on the five campuses here in government. And I'm here today, of course, to speak in support of Senate File 744. I see the need for this change in the law because when medical emergencies arise in these underage drinking situations, young people hesitate to call 911 because of the fear of prosecution for underage drinking. Underage consumption or possession of alcohol under the law currently is a misdemeanor that typically carries a fine of at least $100. Statistics show that this problem is significant. In a 2011 survey of over 12,000 Minnesota college students conducted by the University of Minnesota's Boynton Health Service, 14% of the students surveyed indicated that they would be unlikely to call 911 if they were unable to wake someone that had passed out. And we really want to avoid the potentially tragic outcomes of not getting medical assistance to those that need it. This legislation will help by providing the incentive to call for help by extending immunity from underage consumption and possession of alcohol prosecution when someone seeks help for an immediate medical concern. This bill specifies that both a person that receives medical assistance and a person or a small group of people up to three that called for another person would receive immunity. And I want to emphasize that the only crime that someone could receive immunity from under this bill is minor possession or minor consumption of alcohol. No other crimes are covered. This immunity is only granted when minors voluntarily seek out assistance for an immediate and a legitimate health concern through a health facility, detoxification program, or EMS. I also want to point out something else that might not come to mind at first. This bill won't only help in seeking help in emergencies that are related to like alcohol poisoning or something like that. It could also help encourage a minor that was assaulted or sexually assaulted while drinking to seek medical help and make a police report right away. Currently, individuals in that situation may decide to wait until they sober up to seek assistance because they believe they might be prosecuted for underage drinking. They also might decide not to seek medical help or press charges at all. 10 states and hundreds of college campuses across the nation currently have this policy in place, and this bill is modeled off language that has already been implemented with the consideration of what's best for Minnesota. While crafting this bill, we contacted public health officials in the 10 states that already have medical amnesty, and the responses that we received indicated very positive results, positive responses about our efforts. And many of those officials in other states that we communicated with said that they believe medical amnesty has encouraged young people to seek help. So I think this bill is a simple change in the law that increases access to medical services, and to simply put, I think it'll save lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forstey. And by the way, be sure to sign the testifier sheet when you get a chance. Sir, go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Taylor Williams. I'm the student body president at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I'm originally from Rochester, Minnesota. This bill has widespread support from the community. Students, mayors, council members, and relevant associations like the Minnesota Ambulance Association all believe that this legislation could save lives. We have worked and communicated with relevant officials and interest groups while crafting this legislation to create the most effective policy for Minnesota. In our state, underage drinking is a serious problem that affects tens of thousands of students each year. According to a study done by the Mayo Clinic, 23% of high school age students have participated in high-risk drinking, also known as binge drinking, in the past 14 days. At the collegiate level, over 37% of 20-year-olds have engaged in high-risk drinking in the past 14 days or 2 weeks as well. Whether it is a student who is attending a party and drinking for the first time that becomes ill and needs medical attention, or a young woman who is sexually assaulted and needs to seek help, current state law discourages that individual from seeking assistance. Over the past weeks, I have met with dozens of young people who have had been in situations like the ones described today. These situations happen all too often. We need common sense laws that encourage students to get the help they need when they are in danger. While we will never condone underage drinking, we cannot risk lives and dignity in an effort to be tough on students. This law provides a targeted and limited immunity focused on solving a specific problem. It does not overreach and is carefully written to ensure that underage drinking is not encouraged or becomes more prevalent. Educational organizations like the University of Minnesota will still be able to intervene with their students and undertake corrective or educational action. Furthermore, the law will require individuals seeking help to be the first person to contact a police or peace officer, cooperate fully, and provide their name and contact information while staying on the scene. Medical amnesty law in Minnesota will decrease hesitation to seek help and expand emergency access when it is needed most. In 2006, Cornell University published data that shows the effectiveness of a policy like this. The study showed that alcohol-related EMS calls increased by 22% over the first 2 years of implementation. During this time, Cornell noted that there was no change in underage drinking rates. This increase in EMS calls reflects an increase in reporting when someone needed help. In addition, the study surveyed students about the reasons that they didn't call for help in alcohol-related medical emergencies. Students citing the reason, "I didn't want to get the person or myself in trouble," decreased 61% over that two-year period. Please support this legislation and ensure that we are placing the safety and dignity of young people in Minnesota first. And to close my testimony, I just want to say we talk about a lot of things that the medical amnesty policy will do, like decrease hesitation and increase access for emergency services, but I just want to note a couple of things that it won't do to clarify. If a student or someone else, a young person, is drinking and then decides to drive to emergency hospital or to seek help, they will not be covered for drinking and driving. If a police officer breaks up a party where underage students are drinking, students are not allowed to start yelling medical amnesty and seek amnesty from underage drinking citations. The police officer had initiated contact, and thus no one would be eligible. I think this is a very well-written law that provides a number of safeguards that ensure underage drinking is not encouraged, but also ensures that when people need help, they get it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williams or Mr. Forstie? Where do I start? You had said that if someone would have amnesty or wouldn't have amnesty if they were just in a group of students, but these are adults, correct?
It can be someone who is underage in high school who is a minor. Or someone who's between 18 and 21.
Okay, where does it say that if they're, in a group and they're drinking that they can't just say, hey, I was with him, I want to help and I want to participate, so I should be immune from prosecution here?
Yes, sir. The language states that the... Yes?
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Chair first.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, thank you for your question. The language states specifically that the individual or a caller has to initiate contact with emergency services.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Hall.
What if, hypothetical, a guy rapes a gal, beats her up, realizes what he's done, calls 911 and helps and brings him in because he feels bad about it? Would he not then be prosecuted?
He would be prosecuted.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, that individual will be prosecuted for the crime, of battery and sexual assault.
And where does it say that in here, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, if you look at lines 1.8 and 1.9, you'll see Subdivision 1, Paragraph A, Clause 2, and Subdivision 3 of Section 348.503. So the crimes outlined there that would be qualified for immunity are underage consumption of alcohol and underage possession of alcohol. Crimes like, you know, sexual assault or really any other crime wouldn't qualify for immunity no matter what.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello. So I represent the U, University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, and so I have had conversations with them, and they are supportive of this. They have some concerns, but they've worked it out, and they're supportive. City of Minneapolis has a social ordinance, and they have checked on this, and they are fine with this. They still believe this does not impact that ordinance at all. We've also checked, and I had many people come up to me, since I represent the university area, and they had similar concerns to what Senator Hall said and making sure that this didn't expand and give people a get-out-of-jail-free card. And so we did do checking, and I've talked to emailed several times with Mr. Backus and Ms. Pontius today, and they did alleviate that this does not expand beyond consumption. And it doesn't get around dram shop was another one that somebody pointed out and wanted to make sure that if someone is underage and drinking in a bar, that the bartender can call 911 and then they get off. And they've said, nope, this, because of this, you know, subdivision 1, paragraph A, clause 2, that it is just limited to the people won't be charged for underage drinking and consumption. So I'm very supportive of this. I've asked all of my questions and asked all of my little entities, and they're supportive. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Hall.
I'm still not convinced on it, and I'll tell you why. I'm not sure the idea of not prosecuting somebody for doing wrong because they help somebody else is the right thing to do. Wouldn't it be just a better situation for the person, instead of, if they don't want to be involved, to call somebody else that's not doing some type of crime, to have them call in?
Let me answer. Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, I just want to say that I don't know if you ever went to any drinking parties when you were young, but most of us did, let's
Never.
Admit it. So,
Senator Hall, it's the Fifth Amendment.
That's that I've moniker seen, I'm talking about.
And that was 120 years ago. And if this problem is still happening now, I remember that there were people then that were afraid to call when somebody got very ill. And this problem is still happening. So I really think if we can save one life, or if we can get one person into detox or treatment so that they don't go out and drive a car and kill somebody, I think that it's definitely worth giving them an immunity for taking that action on behalf of somebody else. So we don't think this will solve all minor drinking problems, but it certainly is a step in the right direction for getting help for young people and hopefully saving some lives.
Forrester, you wanted to add something?
I guess I would just add, Mr. Chair and Senator Hall, that a person that would find themselves in this situation and that might receive immunity after being transported to detox, while they would be immune, given immunity from receiving that misdemeanor from the state, they would still face consequences. Of course, they would be responsible for that being transported to detox. They would be responsible if they attended an institution like the University of Minnesota or another college in the state of receiving an intervention or some kind of education that's mandated by those institutions. That wouldn't change. And I think, you know, they would still, you know, have social consequences among, you know, perhaps their friends who wouldn't be happy that their friend went to detox. So I just wanted to point out that I don't think while we give them immunity from the misdemeanor that they're free from really all consequences.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Along that line, I'd like to just follow up. I understand the premise of this to eliminate a barrier that might stop somebody from helping a friend get where they need to go if they have an excessively high blood alcohol level, which can be fatal, really can be fatal, and that the person is immune from underage drinking prosecution. And also it says here the person who receives the medical attention is immune. So everybody who has violated the law by drinking underage is immune from prosecution in this. So, and it's, and the purpose is, as I understood you to say, is to make certain that somebody gets the help they need rather than abandoning a friend who's clearly in trouble. We've had deaths in Mankato because of this kind of problem. But I'm following along with, there's something about that. And you started to talk about something at the university that if I'm underage and I get into an ER and I'm at the University of Minnesota, how does the University of Minnesota have any idea that I've been at the ER in terms of something that's a policy at the university? And is there, if for a high school age student, maybe even college student, is there, they get the help, it may be that they stabilize me in terms of lowering my blood alcohol level and keeping me alive during that time, but what about helping me and you in general in relationship to the whole, if this is a repetitious process, it's not just a one-time kind of thing because I turned 21 or 18 or whatever. There is an issue here besides that doesn't sort of turn that we think about, that we don't turn away from you and say, you know, college kids will be college kids or high school kids will be high school kids and everybody drinks. And believe me, I know that. I've been there. I know what that's about. But as an adult now, I'm not there anymore. I feel an obligation somehow when it becomes apparent to me as an adult that this is happening, that there's an intervention. And so that's what is troubling here. How do we get at the an intervention? Consequence, you know, a penalty is not necessarily an intervention. It's a consequence, but it's not necessarily an intervention.
Mr. Chair,
so talk to me about that.
I'd like to try to answer that, and then I'll let the testifiers answer. Actually, it's only the person that initiates contact for medical care, help, or whatever that is immune from prosecution. It's only the person that initiates it or the person that is themselves, not the rest of the people at the party or anybody else. The other issue is what you're asking is not addressed in here about making sure they get help, but it's certainly not addressed by current law either. This isn't solving all the problems, but it certainly is at least hopefully saving some lives. And those young people should be going into treatment, or they should be going into they should be reporting this incident to their parents or whatever. And sometimes that will happen. You know, if they're below 18, that will happen. That their parents will find out that they've been brought to detox or to a hospital or whatever. But so it can't solve all the problems, but just the only people relieved of that penalty are going to be those people that initiate, that person that initiates the contact, or the person themselves.
Senator Goodwin, just for clarification on that point, it looks like line 1.2, paragraph C also would apply immunity to one or two persons that accompany the person that initiated that contact with peace officer, emergency medical personnel. So if you've got...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct.
Friends all hanging out together.
At the most.
Then you don't have peer pressure on anyone, or no one gets excluded.
Right.
When the report's made, is that, Mr. Williams, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, it is. And if I may follow up on Senator Sharon's question.
Yes, go ahead.
In terms of reporting, we've worked with the University Police Department and local municipality police departments, and rather than reporting an underage drinking citation, there would be a new category created. Essentially a new box that would be checked that says there was an incident and someone was taken to the hospital while, you know, drinking underage. Then the school that was responsible or they were coordinating with would receive that information to give psychoeducational therapy, as currently happens at the university.
Just to follow, the box that's checked is by whom?
By the police or peace officer.
Okay, so then they report that back to the university.
And I just feel compelled to address your question about how are we addressing the issue on a greater level and how do we provide intervention. And that's something we've worked with the university on for many months. And I think it's outside of the scope of this law, but, you know, examples would include funding for psychoeducational programs that try to, you know, educate the young person on the dangers of underage drinking or binge drinking. I think a discussion should be had about how, as a state, we can try to create an atmosphere where we can intervene when students are going off the right path, if you will.
And Senator Latz, one more question. This check-the-box situation, is that true for high school students then? And does it go to the high school or go to the parents if they're under 18?
My understanding, Mr. Chair and Senator, is that if the young person is under 18, that their parents will be notified.
Any further discussion? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, I'm a co-author on your bill. I think it's a good bill. But I did have one question, and that's, what kind of obligation are we putting on the police that are going to come to this? Are they obligated to respond? Do they have a priority that they can recognize in their own calls if there's something else going on? Does that create a liability for them?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, that can be asked of any bills we have before us that are related to any kind of crime. But, the burden on the police. So I'm sure there will be police calls that maybe wouldn't have come before. You're right. That's, you know, I think I highly doubt that the police would feel like it was an imposition to possibly save the lives of a young person and or stop the drinking at the party.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I could see where this might be used in more of a isolated case. At least I'd hope so. But I could also see a case where you have a kegger with hundreds of kids enjoying themselves on a Friday night, and the local campus police gets a call for 50 calls all at the same time. And I'm just wondering, that's why I'm wondering about the obligation of law enforcement. They might have crowd control, they might have other things going on all at that same time. Maybe it's the end of a football game and they're trying to deal with traffic all in a very tight, compressed area, and now they have this to respond to. No, it's going to be a busy night for that police department, but
Mr. Chair,
is there any liability?
Senator Limmer, the alternative is to let these kids die or choke to death on their own vomit or end up getting so drunk and having some brain damage or getting in their car and driving. And I think the police, I can't speak for the police, but I would assume that they would rather break up a party and take somebody in to get help rather than to attend a drunk driving accident or see the child or the young person get die or have to have some kind of brain damage or something. So yeah, there's work that's going to happen, and I don't know how much or how often. I don't think it's going to be as often as you might think, because I think it'll take a lot to get people to even know that they should do this, that they should call and that they won't get charged. That education is a big piece of it. And, you know, whatever way we can spread that word would be good, just so they know that they have the ability and the right to call in without getting charged.
Mr. Backus, as to
and thank you for being a co-author, Senator Limmer.
As to police liability, Mr. Backus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I don't see any liability under the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall, and then Senator Dietz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be facetious here, and so I'll start out by telling you that. Why are we not giving them a complete get out of jail? Why not make it so that when you go back to university, they can't do any prosecuting? Why not give them a $100 card to buy something sometime? And why not have the mayor give them an award if it'll save one life? I guess I'm still not sold that you let somebody off, and the reasoning of saving one life. You could say a lot of things about saving one life we could do, and I'm not sure that's a good discussion on it.
Senator,
help me out, though.
Senator Sharon, in response to Senator Holmes.
Yes, because I think that we share a discomfort about something,
mm-hmm.
But I'm hearing, and my discomfort is the potential for the enabling of the abuse of alcohol, which is huge, and because we are taking away a consequence, so to speak. But what I'm hearing is that you take away this consequence that seems to be reported in the data as a reason for not intervening in a friend's life in order to achieve that objective, an intervention, that the consequence for this underage drinking isn't death or isn't some enormous toxic consequence physiologically, because the judgment is poor. We know they ought to take it, suck it up, and take your friend in. I mean, we all know that. But at that age, it's a big deal. They lose scholarships, maybe they lose all sorts of consequences. So they don't do it. They don't understand that alcohol is going to kill you at that level. So how do I resolve what I think I share with you is, if it's not going to be a consequence here, how do I make sure that I'm not just establishing an enabling system which just churns this kind of party excessive drinking, and that we don't have something that interferes with the enabling of that. What I heard the students say is that they have a check by the, there's a check on a form that there is some intervention at the university around the drinking or for the underage drinker that the parent is informed. So there is that potential for intervention unless the parents just turn their head and university doesn't have an effective intervention program.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't it also a crime not to help somebody that's hurting?
It's the Mr. Chair. I think he's talking about the Good Samaritan law.
No, that would be if you're helping somebody that's hurting. So if I saw somebody,
there's no crime for the. I'm sorry. Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, oh, no, sorry, Mr. Chairman. That law was amended, I think, about 10 years. There is a duty to respond, but calling 911 is sufficient.
Okay.
So that was a change in the law.
So what I'm saying, Mr. Chair, is they have a good reason to make that call. I'm not sure we need to give them immunity. They already have a good reason because they'd be prosecuted if they didn't make the call or do something.
Senator Hall, only if they're found out.
Yeah, that's right.
They won't be prosecuted if no one ever knows that they failed to make the call.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, I respect that observation. One of the important things for me to note here is that identified by our public health officials at the university, when it comes to underage drinking, bystander prevention is a large issue. And when there is a potential emergency medical situation, there's a gray area. I can't identify for sure if my friend is, you know, in a life-threatening situation. So when there are fewer barriers, I'm more able to seek help when possibly they are or are not. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I still oppose the bill, but it does make sense.
Senator Hall, for the record, the duty to assist under the Good Samaritan Law, 604A.01, subdivision 1, failure to provide that assistance is a petty misdemeanor.
Okay. One more, Senator.
Not considered a crime.
One more here.
Senator Sherman.
Have you thought, as the students have looked at this, you have included that the person who receives the medical assistance shall also be immune from prosecution. It applies to one or two persons acting in concert with the person using it. Have you thought about limiting the number of times you get out of jail free for the person who's receiving the medical attention? And that's a very high abuse level when you're needing to go into the ER because you're becoming comatose, really. You're shutting down all of the functions of the central nervous system that keep you alive. You drink at that level, you guys. So it's serious, and I understand what you're doing here, but what if Mary takes Angela this weekend, and next weekend it's Tom, and the next weekend it's Andrew? Now we've got Angie in the ER three times with a get-out-of-jail card. What? That's hard for me as a practitioner in the field of mental health and chemical dependency and past practice to have that enabling going on. But I understand what you want to do here, but I want you to hear what I'm concerned about, which is this addiction to substances. So can you consider a limitation that it's not for the person helping, but for the person getting the help, or this person under 1.20, how many get-out-of-jail-free cards do you want to give your friends? Because there's a tougher intervention then, and it creates a wake-up call. It helps in that progression of, hey, wake up here. This isn't just the first DWI, for example. This is the second. I mean, the third one, you're going to lose your driver's license. Well, what about that? Would you respond to me about that?
Senator Sheeran, I'll just say I'm a little concerned about if the friends knowing that this would be the third time that
I don't think
goes,
they know it. I don't think they know it.
Well, they may or may not, but if they do, they may say, well, okay, now I'm not going to call 911 because this one is going to cause Angie to face misdemeanor criminal charges, and that may be the third big drunk in an episode, maybe the fatal one. It's a competing incentives, and I guess the question is, where do you fall on the balance there? I guess I'd rather fall on the balance of getting them into the emergency room even a third time, even if they're not going to face misdemeanor criminal charges. I would also suspect at that point there are other interventions that are being involved. But that's just my thought on it. I don't know if anyone else wants to add. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I shared that idea with Senator Sheeran because I know that has been bounced around back and forth a few times, and it is, and I do go back and forth, where is that fine line? Because, you don't want on the third, three strikes you're out, and have that one they don't call because they know three strikes they're out, and so then that's the time they die. But there is that level of how are they, sanctioned, because this is, a serious situation. I know from the university and talking with the University of Minnesota, they do get, and they currently do work with their university police and the Minneapolis police, and when they're are youth students that have interacted with the police and have either from suicides to just minor infractions, they administration does get notified, and so they are aware of what is happening to certain students. And so I think this will be, with that box being checked, they will know, and they know who it is, and so they will be able to, hopefully intervene. And this does not give that student this immunity from sanctions at the university. And so they can, not only provide treatment, but they can also, potentially lose scholarship funds or be kicked out of the dorm or certain other things. So there is some level of accountability there. Senator Limmer had asked about, in talking to the police liability, if there's a big party. Well, if there's parties at the U, there's police and there's fire department. And so in the city of Minneapolis, the first responder is actually the fire department. And so it's not used, if there's, and again, this is just Minneapolis, where I'm familiar with, there's a party at the University of Minnesota and there's traffic because there's a football game. You have police and you have the fire department responding. And so I think they use their best judgment on any given day currently. So I think they can handle when it's a big party. And, and the bottom line is someone does need medical attention, and so it can't just be a party and somebody's tipsy and say, oh, yeah, we were going to call. We want our get-out-of-jail-free card. I think they have some discretion to decide that this person is really needing medical attention. So we've been weighing this back and forth. I've been talking with the city and the county and the ambulance drivers and the U, and so we've been going back and forth. We think the bottom line, the concept is good, and it's not just saving one life. It's helping to educate the students. This is not good, and then it gets into the whole binge drinking. And so, again, if you can just get students talking and people talking about, underage drinking and don't drink, I think that's a good thing too. So.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Franklin, did you want to add something to the conversation here on behalf of the Sheriff's Association?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jim Franklin for Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. If I could make two observations to start with. Number one.
And former police chief.
I wasn't going to mention that, sir.
And former director of public safety in the city of Mankato.
So lots of
my life is coming forward. I want to say something, number one. These are great kids. I've talked with several of them, and I think the effort that they're bringing forward is great. They're sharp kids, and I wish them the very best. Number two is I would say each of you should be very concerned because I think your seats may be violated and taken from you at some point in the election. These are great kids coming up. So just think about that, Senator Limmer.
Especially his seat.
with that, I think this is a real problem. And I'll just start with what we tell our cops. Number one, I don't care what you do wrong, you do the right thing and you never lie. If somebody needs help and something has happened, you never lie. You tell the truth, you move forward. And so I would start with the kids the same way. You should never hold back from calling for someone that needs help. Never. Point number two that I would make. We as law enforcement officers, and I had the great privilege of working in Mankato for a number of years as their police chief and director of public safety. We went to the college with the freshman kids and said, number one, don't drink, but we know you will. If you do, do it on your private property, in your rooms and whatever. Don't get out in the public property where we have to deal with you. Number three, when we do come, we'll help you. We don't have to give everybody a ticket. We have discretion. Our prosecution has discretion. We do not have to write everybody a citation. And so I bring forth some of the things that I have concerns about here as the slippery slope of criminal activity and what we are doing and what kind of message we are sending. Senator Sharon has already addressed a part of my concern, the frequency of this. What do we do? How many times in a year do you get to play this card? And I had some discussion today with several of the students about how can we deal with this on an educational level. We've focused on the University of Minnesota. There are 87 sheriff's offices and 300-plus police departments. We've talked about one, the University of Minnesota. We have a much larger problem that needs to be dealt with than just one police agency that these kids are from. We also don't have a definition as to what constitutes cooperation. And so I don't want to see us get all tangled up in the issues of cooperation, how we define that as law enforcement agencies and interpret that. We all know it deals with kids that are drinking and cops that are tired in the middle of the night. It boils down to attitude and behavior. And I've had kids on both sides of that, and I've had my supervisors and ask them to stand down and not issue tickets. And in other cases, issuing tickets was appropriate because of behavior. But I see potential problems with this language and what it may bring about. And I don't want to clog up the courts by sending these cases in for definition. All of this is brand new. We have no way of knowing exactly how the courts will rule on a number of these things. And I also want to point out, we as law enforcement officers have some real problems or issues dealing with the exchange of information. With the student that has a medical situation, under HIPAA, we cannot forward that on to someone. We are restricted. Additionally, we have data practice issues about sending information on, and especially if it's juvenile information. But in my discussion with some of the kids, I think this is something that we want to continue to work on. Unfortunately, we in the law enforcement community, as sheriffs, weren't engaged in the front end of the conversation. Like so many things, we're coming in on the backside when we see a bill. But I do think there's educational components here that we could collectively and cooperatively work with, and especially with our communities that have universities where this is a larger problem. So with that, I'll conclude, sir, and say that this is we understand what we're trying to do. We just don't think that this is the right exact way to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin.
Senator Latz, can I ask Senator?
Yes,
Mr.
Senator
Franklin,
Sharon.
Would you remind me, it's been a while, but this you're talking about data privacy. The issuing, not a citation necessarily, but just giving information to the university, Minnesota State Mankato, University of Minnesota, that this has occurred with the person's name, is that allowable under current law? This intervention that they're talking about, checking a box and having it go back to the university where the student engages in a process because of a university policy if an incident is reported, is that all allowable under law without a violation, without you issuing a violation of the law?
Mr. Franklin. Mr. Chairman, Senator, I am not familiar with the check the box at the University of Minnesota. I think that does not or may have something to do with information that has come to them outside of the scope of law enforcement. I'm not sure how, if law enforcement is, quote, checking a box and sending it to the university. I don't know quite how they're doing that, and that's part of what I would have to gain some additional information on. Secondly, if the student is medically somehow in treatment and we have that data as law enforcement, that becomes medical data, and we have issues with what we can release. Additionally, while we might be talking a student that is 18 or older, anybody younger than that gets into the juvenile data of what we're releasing. So there are regulations with regards to that particular piece. And then how did we come with this data, and whether or not there's any kind of thing under a mental health hold? Again, there's a number of questions here that would have to be sorted out, and I just really don't have the answers until we drill down on some of those issues.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I have one point to make here, and that is that, thank you, Mr. Chair. The students have worked with the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and they have no objections to this bill. I'm sure if you go to law enforcement, you'll find some that do and some that don't. But once again, I want to say sometimes, you know, around here we use a stick approach to everything, and this is a carrot approach, and I really believe that it can help save some lives. And there are issues that can be resolved, but they really don't have they don't have a lot to do with just making sure that people can call and that people can get their friends or themselves the treatment that they need when they need it immediately and not have to pause and think about whether or not it's okay. Those other issues about education, mental health, those are issues that hopefully we will deal with around here. They're big issues, but they're not really attached to this. And anybody can put a bill together that does additional things that they want it to do on top of this. But just this alone is going to, I really do believe it'll save lives. And I really do believe that we can't anticipate every eventuality. If somebody's going to go three times in 3 weeks to the hospital or whatever, eventually they're going to suffer a lot of their own consequences out of that. But I still don't think that encourages them to drink. I think they would be drinking regardless of whether or not they went to the hospital every week or went into treatment every week. They'd still be drinking because those folks have a big problem with alcohol, and they do need treatment. But this isn't about that. We're making this much more complicated than it is. This is only about people being able to get help when they need it, and especially young people that don't and often use their heads when it comes to drinking and things like that. They don't. Sometimes they have to learn through their own bad experiences. But if this can stop them, or if it can even give them the help they need, or if their parents are called or whatever, that's a step in the right direction. They get nothing without this. They get nothing but a penalty, and it's much more likely that they're going to not call and get the help they need.
I think so.
Senator Orban.
I think Senator Hall was next, and then I would like
Senator
to.
Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As others have stated, I think the goal of this is really good, but I think the experience of Mr. Franklin, which is what I was going to say before he got up there, in the sense that I think there are other stakeholders here that would look at this, and I think we need some other wisdom, maybe Alcoholics Anonymous, mental health, psychologists to look at this to say, is this the right way? I don't think we brought everybody together on this enough. So at this point, I would be voting no about it.
Senator Ortman, and then we're going to draw this discussion to a close here.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wanted to say, Senator Goodwin, and to all of the advocates that are here, I think this is heading in the right direction. We are public policy makers, Senator Goodwin, right? And I think this is good public policy. I think that sometimes we get tied down into the details of how things would work instead of being able to set our policy goals. And I agree with you that this is a policy goal, not just because I'm a mom, but also I was a resident assistant back in college. I dealt with some of these issues at McAllister College, and they were very real issues, and you want folks to get help instead of being afraid to call. And so I agree with your public policy. I think we're going to have to address some of the details. I hope you'll come back next year and work on this again and try and respond. But I, Senator Goodwin, I want you to know you have my full support and help. And I think that we need to really remind ourselves that we're policymakers, and we don't have to have all the answers to all the details before we sit in front of a committee. It's one of the most frustrating things this year, I think, is the expectation that we have everything worked out when we really are policymakers. And maybe this is just one that's not ripe yet, because we do need to have more direction for folks that will implement the law. And I think that should be the focus of the efforts going forward. How would this policy, if it's a good policy, be implemented going forward?
With that said, Senator Goodwin,
where does it go,
moves Senate File 744 be recommended to pass, be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
It's not good.
All right.
Senator
Ortman, we have Senate.
You call the division. Mr. Chair, I would move at this time that we lay 1187 on the table so that we can move forward with Senate File 1269, but I would appreciate the opportunity for Mr. Kasbaum to be able to testify about what's happening with the FLAB and his recommendations going forward.
Absolutely, Senator Orban. Now, before we get to Senate File 1269, let's deal with Senate File 834. I'm going to ask Senator Goodwin to come over and chair.
Senator Latz is presenting Senate File 834, and let me say thank you, Senator Latz, for letting me have both my bills heard and delaying your own for that time.
No problem, Senator Goodwin. Madam Chair, I'd ask the committee to consider Senate File 834. This deals with the State Guardian Ad Litem Board, modifies some of the provisions, and I have with me today the program administrator for the Guardian Ad Litem program, Susan Allegro. I'd ask you to hear Ms. Allegro describe the bill.
Good afternoon, or good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We're proposing some changes, mainly technical amendments, and one somewhat of a substantive amendment that the new Guardian Ad Litem Board would like to see passed. Section 1 amends 260B-163, subdivision 6, and basically we're striking language in Section D, or any agent or employee thereof. And the reason for this is that the current language prevents a guardian ad litem manager or coordinator who files a delinquency or child protection petition from being able to appoint one of the guardian ad litems on that matter. Section 2 contained in 260B.331, and it has to do with, in Subdivision 6, guardian ad litem fees. And what we're seeking to do here is clarify the language to refer to guardian ad litem as opposed to guardian, which is another defined term in the statute. Section 3 is 260C.163, Subdivision 5. And again, we're asking that the language be stricken or any agent or employee thereof. And again, the reason is that the current language prevents a guardian ad litem manager or coordinator who files a child protection petition to then be able to appoint one or more of their guardians on that matter. Section 4 is 260.331, and that deals with the guardian ad litem fees. And similar to the delinquency fees, that we're adding the ad litem, and again, it's to clarify that it's guardian ad litem, not guardian. Section 5 amends the State Guardian Ad Litem Board Statute 480.35, Subdivision 1, the structure and membership. And what we're asking here is that currently the law provides that the Supreme Court appoint the chair of the board, and we're asking that this be changed, that the board elect their chair. And the reason is that the program is now taken out of the court system and the board is established, and the board recommends that it be able to elect its own chair, similar to the public defender. Our board chair has checked with the Chief Justice regarding her, if she had any problem with this change in the language, and she's okay with our seeking to change it. Section 6 deals with 518.165, Subdivision 1, permissive appointment of a guardian ad litem, and we're asking that the language from a panel established by the court be stricken, and that basically what the reason is it strikes an obsolete reference to a panel established by the court. We use employees. We don't use a panel established by the court, and this language is irrelevant since the creation of the board. The final two have to do with Section 7 of 518.165, Subdivision 3, fees. We're asking that in A, the language be stricken. A guardian ad litem appointed under Subdivision 1 or 2 may be appointed either on a volunteer or on a fee basis. And we feel this language is unnecessary under the new board, and I think it's also confusing that we do use in some of our, not in family court, but in juvenile court, we do use volunteers, so this language is confusing. We're also asking that the language be stricken regarding the costs of court-appointed counsel shall be paid by the state guardian ad litem if the party is incapable of paying. And the reason for this is that this is inconsistent with long-established practice. The program always pays for counsel for the guardian ad litem, not the parties. And the board should decide and manage the retention and payment of counsel. So those are the amendments that we're asking for.
Thank you, Ms. Allegro. Senator Latz? Anybody want to? Excuse me?
That's all we have.
Anybody want to testify for or against this bill? Okay, members have any questions? Guess not. Okay. Then Senator Latz moves Senate file number 834 to the floor, I believe. Is that correct, Mr. Senator Latz?
So, yes.
Is that right? Okay. Senate file number 834, Senator Latz moves to the floor. And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Next on the agenda is Senate File 1269, Crime Lab Accreditation, Senator Latz. Accreditation. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have an author's amendment.
And that would be amendment. Sure, I have it here. Okay, that would be the A2 amendment, excuse me. Senator Latz moves the A2 amendment. Did you want to explain the amendment first, or do you want to explain the whole bill with the amendment on it?
Please add the amendment, then I'll explain.
Okay. Senator Latz moves A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, nay. All right. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I've no doubt that each of you have become aware over the course of extensive media attention in the last couple of years about the problems with the St. Paul Crime Lab and the pursuit of information investigation by two public defenders in the Dakota County Court relating to forensic analysis and results from lab tests done at the St. Paul Crime Lab that were used to, in some cases, to pursue criminal charges, serious felony criminal charges against individuals in Dakota County. And in the course of that issue, substantial problems came to light about the procedures in the St. Paul Crime Lab, the practices, whether they comported with industry standards and accepted scientific practices in the field, and had the effect of raising doubt about the validity of the results of those lab tests, not only in the relatively few cases that were specifically being challenged by the Public Defender's Office, but also in hundreds of cases that have had the results of these lab analyses used to convict persons charged with serious crimes. The analysis went on for many, many months, and Judge Mesrich in Dakota County has presided over extensive hearings on this, and the county attorneys in a number of counties, Dakota County, Ramsey County, I think Washington County, among others, have been paying close attention and have been evaluating and reevaluating the use of lab results in cases that resulted in convictions. There have, in fact, been some specific cases where samples that still existed in connection with cases were reevaluated by the BCA lab, and different results were obtained. In one case, an analysis in which they were unable to identify the presence of a controlled substance, it turned out that a controlled substance was found in the sample, and in a couple of other cases, there were some findings where controlled substances that had been found, in fact, were not found upon replication, and there were substantial questions raised because of the procedures about contamination resulting in lab samples. So this has become a very challenging problem, and I think it's important that whatever side of the criminal justice system you're on, whether you're prosecuting or whether you're defending, that the public and all the parties to the process have confidence that the crime labs in the state are producing results that are as reliable as can possibly be under the circumstances. It's important for the public confidence that the evidence which is presented by the prosecution have substantial reliability. So as juries are trying to evaluate whether or not the state has met their burden of proof, they will be able to have a certain amount of reliance on that, subject, of course, to the judicial process and the ability of the defense to question and cross-examine the state's witnesses. In fact, that's exactly the kind of question that brought some of these substandard practices to light. And, of course, it's important not only for the ability to prosecute and convict the right people of the right crimes, but also that we do not convict those who, in fact, did not commit a crime, and that false positive reports of the presence of, for example, controlled substances or of DNA matches and so on do not have the effect of wrongfully convicting and putting in prison for years, a person that did not commit a crime. So for all those reasons, I have brought forth the bill that you have before you that would require that forensic laboratories in Minnesota be accredited. The accreditation process is one which has, in fact, been accomplished by five labs in the state of Minnesota, including the Hennepin County Sheriff's Lab, the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Target has a private lab that is also accredited. But there are, I think the number is around 15, 16 or so additional labs in Minnesota that are conducting forensic laboratory analysis, the results of which are used in the prosecution of crimes that are not accredited. and there are nationally recognized accreditation standards from the American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors Laboratory Accreditation Board, affectionately known as ASCLAB, and there's another accrediting body called the International Laboratory Accreditation Cooperative, and there are also some other standards that make reference to ISO standards in particular. So I will tell you that, you know, for many years there existed a Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board in Minnesota, and their existence expired as a part of the Sunset Commission's actions, followed up by the legislature. And I was in conversations for many months with them, and I'm going to ask at the appropriate time for Brian Kasbaum, who was affiliated with them, to come and testify today. And they were kind of an oversight body, but they were never really funded and never really given the kind of powers and authority that would make their work meaningful. And so I was in discussions with them about what the best way forward was under these circumstances. After conversations with them and with a number of others who are familiar with this field, I reached the conclusion that we can accomplish accreditation by mandating it and by having the proof of accreditation supplied to the Department of Public Safety and have the Commissioner of Public Safety posted on their website, but without reconstituting a state board and having to fund them or anything like that. And so I thought the most efficient and the most cost-effective way to do this was the bill that you have before you. So what it does is it defines what forensic analysis is. Defines the individuals that would qualify for purposes of doing that forensic analysis, including linking it to the likelihood of that testimony, of the results of that analysis being used in the courtroom proceedings. It also defines forensic laboratory, which essentially forensic analysis on items of evidence that are part of or have the potential to be used in a criminal investigation. So this would not apply to the gathering of evidence at the crime scene, when the purpose of that gathering is simply to preserve the evidence for later analysis by a forensic laboratory. There were some questions raised in the course of my conversations and the introduction of this bill about the timeline that was originally provided, and the amendment that you have adopted addressed that timeline issue. The original bill provided that the accreditation be required by January 1 of 2014. I have been informed that that would be too quick a timeline for labs to go through the accreditation process. And there was one suggestion that it be changed to 2016. But what I have proposed in the A2 amendment was to make it 2015, which would give almost 2 years for the labs to get accredited from now, which should be enough time under most circumstances. But I provided a provision that the Commissioner of Public Safety may, for good cause, if they're satisfied that adequate progress is being made toward accreditation, may extend that time period for the unaccredited laboratory to continue their process of getting accreditation. And then I have also in the A2 amendment, added another reference to one of the ISO standards that would be applicable, and provided additionally the reference to the International Laboratory Accreditation Cooperative. So there are a couple of accreditation bodies that would be appropriate. So what I would like...
Madam Chair.
Biddy.
Senator Ortman.
Senator Letts. I thought that it made a lot of sense to move forward with Senate File 1269 because of the deadline. Because that January 1, 2014 was very important, because it would then have required every crime lab in the state to either restrict its actions to gathering and processing, which is not an engaging in the scientific analysis, right? Or if they were engaging in the scientific analysis of these samples, then they would be required to follow accreditation standards and earn the accreditation. That deadline was very important, and I'm concerned about the change here, because then it leaves open that kind of window in between where we could have crime labs that are engaging in the scientific analysis and not be following accreditation standards and have the peer review and everything else like that, which again calls into question some of the evidence that we're relying on in court. And I thought the biggest challenge when we had the problems with the St. Paul Crime Lab was credibility, that we had crime labs in the state of Minnesota that had tainted evidence, that had hundreds and hundreds of samples that now have to be retested. We have thousands of cases that are affected, and I don't want that to happen again. And so closing that window and saying by January 2014, you are either in the business of only processing or you are accredited, that was a safety valve for me. Then I was sure that we weren't going to have any more bad samples. We weren't going to have any more of the problems that we had in the St. Paul Crime Lab. So I'm concerned about the A2 amendment. And I think that if you extend the period from 2014 to 2015 and then also provide that kind of discretionary period for the commissioner, we've defeated our purpose of saying, let's be clear, you're either processing or you're engaged in scientific analysis, and we have expectations if you are. I'm really worried about what this amendment does, and I hope that you would reconsider both aspects, the date and then also the discretionary period. I'm also not sure, Senator Lotz, that I agree that it's the Commissioner of Public Safety who should decide whether or not a crime lab is going through sufficiently through the accreditation process. I'm not sure why the commissioner, why that position. That's one of the reasons why I thought the FLAB had some merit, that Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board professionals from across all jurisdictions could then come and talk to us at the legislature and say, we have some problems with what's happening. So I'm concerned about that, and I hope that you'll address that, because I was not expecting the A2 amendment tonight.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lotz.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, I appreciate your concerns. I've been trying to find a way to make that work, because I've been told that January 1, 2014, which is less than a year away, is simply not enough time for the accreditation process to be initiated and successfully completed. So I was trying to find a date that would be reasonable in allowing that to occur. Now, maybe the way I've crafted it is a little too lenient on that. I'm certainly open to making modifications to that.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I know there are very few that are accredited. I'm wondering if there are a number, maybe the experts here can tell us, if there are others that would fall into this window. Are we just talking about one? Are we talking about two? Which crime labs are looking for that leeway to earn the accreditation but want to continue in the scientific analysis portion of the business in the meantime? I think we should at least know that before we again begin to address this.
Sure. Madam Chair,
Senator,
I ask that we keep that in mind and that we hear from Frank DeLeschi, who is here from the BCA lab, and also Brian Kasbaum from the FLAB. And then let's see what they have to say, and maybe we'll follow up afterward.
All right. Thank you.
So,
Senator Lotz, you want to bring up your testifiers? Please state your name for the record, and please don't forget to sign in at the end.
My name is Brian Kasbaum. I'm the chairman of the Minnesota Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to let me speak to you this evening. The board was created in 2006. At that time, Minnesota was a trendsetter, joining only a few other states with groups of people assembled specifically to address improving forensic science services. The board consists of 12 members with three primary functions. First, the board is responsible for developing a system by which professional negligence or misconduct in the state's forensic science laboratories can be reported. When misconduct or negligence is reported, the board assumes an investigatory role. Investigative procedures, including preparation of a written and publicly available report, corrective actions, Retroactive review of laboratory operations and follow-up evaluations of the laboratory are set forth in the authorizing legislation. Secondly, the board encourages laboratories to become accredited by an appropriate body and develop and implement a process for those laboratories to report their accreditation status. Third, the board is charged with collecting data on monitoring evidence analysis turnaround times. It must recommend to the legislature case processing guidelines for laboratories to follow and proposals for improvement of report turnaround times. So what has the board accomplished? The board has recommended forensic analysis processing time guidelines, recommended the establishment of regional lab facilities to supplement the work of the state BCA lab. This report was submitted to the legislature through Commissioner Campion in 2008. The board has provided annual reports to the legislature and developed a policy and procedure manual that describes in detail the investigation process. The board has returned to the legislature each year since creation with two primary objectives: to seek funding and to make accreditation mandatory for publicly funded crime labs. The board has never received any funding from the legislature and currently has no budget, no staff, no state office, no phone number, no email. The public has not been invited to report to the board any concerns about negligence or misconduct because the board continues to lack any funds to undertake any substantive investigation of those concerns. The board is unable to initiate a contract with a vendor qualified to perform or assist an investigation or provide a resource. The board has minimal capacity to provide meaningful mandatory reports as directed by the legislation, and the board lacks any staff to assist the board with its duties. The legislature has never made accreditation mandatory. I'm not here tonight to poke your chest with my finger and tell you we told you so. However, the disaster within the St. Paul Police Crime Lab and the unwanted attention in the local and national media that has tarnished Minnesota's criminal justice system and cost taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars was preventable. We have an opportunity tonight to think as risk managers. Without the recognition that is associated with accreditation, Minnesota crime laboratories have no way to demonstrate to the criminal justice system and the public that the laboratory conforms to strict standards and follows accepted scientific principles. Requiring crime laboratories to become accredited is the single most important step you, as legislators, can take toward improving forensic science services in Minnesota. I'm also asking that you appropriate $40,000 for each of the next 2 years for a part-time staff person and office to support the board with its duties and once again make Minnesota a trendsetter in providing forensic science services.
Senator Latz.
Thank you. Ask her, Mr. DeLeschi, also to testify.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Frank Dolish. I'm the director of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Lab. Our laboratory is accredited by the American Crime Laboratory Laboratory Accreditation Board, known as ASCLAD Lab. The accreditation process that our laboratory and as well as the Target Laboratory, the Minneapolis PD Laboratory, and the Hennepin County Lab, who are also accredited under that program, involves meeting standards of what's called ISO 17025. That's International Organization for Standardization. 17025 is specifically designed for testing laboratories. It's much actually broader than just crime laboratories. The addition of the language on the amendment that adds a reference to forensic laboratories and standards developed by the International Laboratory Accreditation Cooperative, or ILAC, are also essential to a good operating crime laboratory. The reference to 17020 is a reference that is applied to mainly to forensic processing units, so crime scene units. It can be applied to latent print examination units, but 17025 also applies to latent print units. And the way I read the language in Senator Latt's bill, I don't believe that it would be required under that language that a crime scene processing unit be accredited. They're collecting evidence. As long as they're not actually analyzing it and writing reports, they would not be required to be accredited. ASCLAD Lab does, however, accredit it in the crime scene processing area, and both the BCA crime scene processing unit and I believe Hennepin County Labs crime scene processing units are accredited under ISO 17025. I strongly support, I believe that our department strongly supports mandatory accreditation for laboratories in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
I wonder if Mr. Dolish can address the question of how long it would take for an unaccredited laboratory to become accredited.
The process, if you've done all of the policies and procedures and have everything in place, would take probably through the end of the year. I have had some discussions with the Tri-County Lab in Anoka, who is, they're one of the laboratories that are not accredited currently. It's their intention to become accredited. They have been working on that, on the process of getting ready for accreditation, and it's likely that they may be able to meet the deadline by the end of this year, but it's not a sure thing. Part of the process is that you have to be able to get on the calendar of the accreditation body and have them come in and do an assessment. And because most of these organizations rely on volunteers to do those assessments, it usually takes several months before you can get on the agenda to actually be assessed to become accredited. So I think having a deadline at the end of the year would be difficult. And for some labs, if they haven't started the process, it might be impossible to do it in that time frame.
Madam Chair, I wonder if Mr. Dolish could recommend a time frame for those labs that haven't started the process yet, if they choose to become accredited.
Mr. Dolasi.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senator Latz, I would say probably 2 years.
I'm sorry?
I understand. How many? 2 years. I understand Senator Ortman's concern about what do you do in the meantime. And I think that laboratories that are serious about this can be performing to the standards of accreditation, which is more important than the piece of paper at the end of the tunnel. And so I'd say that if they're committed to this, they start operating according to these standards and then go through the process, then I wouldn't be quite as worried. If you're just saying that, well, I'm just going to sit here for 2 years and not do anything, then I would be worried.
Senator Ortman.
That's my concern, is that we would have labs that are engaged in forensic analysis in the meantime not trying to meet accreditation standards. And I can't imagine, Senator Lass, that you disagree with me, that they should either be
working towards accreditation and following the standards during this time period, or they should be barred from engaging in forensic analysis. And so maybe what we can do, Senator Latz, is work on some kind of language that says that they're, maybe they've, you know, begun the formal process of accreditation by a certain date. That would at least relieve my concern. Then we wouldn't have the Commissioner of Public Safety, who's really not related to these issues at all, granting extensions and everything else. I would like to ask, if I could, Madam Chair, Mr. Dolish, you talked about the Tri-County Forensic Lab, and I know the St. Paul Crime Lab is not yet accredited. I've read, I think, that they're planning to go through accreditation. Are there any other labs that you know of in Minnesota that are engaging in forensic analysis that are not accredited besides those two?
Mr. Teleshi.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, there are a number of police departments and sheriff's departments that have units that are doing latent print identification that would qualify under this statute that would not be that probably aren't even thinking about accreditation at this point in time. They're probably one or two people, units, maybe associated with their crime scene processing units.
Madam Chair, if perhaps Mr. Kasbaum could also address that question.
Mr. Cash, I'm sorry. I want to get your name right.
Kasbaum.
All right. I don't think I will, but thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Hartman, that's an excellent question. How many labs are out there? How many agencies are providing some sort of forensic science service? The board, on a volunteer basis, attempted to find out what law enforcement agencies in this state were providing for services. The Public Defender's Office, under a grant, had an intern also asking that same question. What we found was that there are about a dozen agencies, not the accredited agencies that we're talking about, but other agencies in the state that are providing some sort of service. The problem is those agencies don't really know what service they are providing. And I don't say that in a derogatory fashion. We sent out a survey. We made phone calls. Oftentimes we tried to get in touch with the head of that agency who might refer us to somebody else. And it was apparent in talking to those people that they weren't exactly sure what service their agency was providing, whether it was just putting things in bags or whether they were actually doing drug chemistry, footwear, bullet trajectory, bloodstain pattern analysis. So I think that question needs to be looked at, and that is a perfect example of why the advisory board is necessary, a group that would have the authority, if you gave them that authority, to go out and look at what these laboratories are doing. It may require looking at their case files, helping to answer that question, are they an agency that is going to be required under this legislation to become accredited? We've done the best job we could at defining language that attempts to separate crime scene processors from those that are conducting an analysis, but we don't have a full handle on it.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there a lot of the police departments that do partial forensic analysis where they have equipment to do part, but not at a point where they'd ever want to become official lab? And would they be then cut out or prohibited from even doing partial forensic if this goes into effect?
Mr. Kasbaum?
Madam Chair, members, Senator Hall, I don't know where to draw the line between a partial and a full forensic analysis. If you look at the language that we've crafted and follow that definition, I think anyone who is conducting an analysis would have to become accredited, which means if they're not accredited, All they really should be doing is preserving and packaging evidence and transporting it to a crime lab. You still have kind of a quizzical look on your face. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
No, I think you kind of did. I guess I'm looking at my Burnsville Police Department, where I think they probably do some, and I'm not sure exactly what they do. But I wouldn't want them to have to, and they probably do it well enough to pass whatever qualifications or tests that for that part they would be able to do. But they're not necessarily a forensic lab. They just have some that they do.
Mr. Kasbaum.
Madam Chair, Member Senator Hall. I don't want to see any forensic science provider out there necessarily go away. We need all these agencies to process crime scenes and bring evidence in to be examined. That's not the intent. However, we'll use Burnsville as an example. If they are doing more than that, they need to demonstrate that they're following established scientific principles, that they have validated their processes, that they validated their equipment, and so on and so forth. They need to have peer review of their reports, and if they are not following those steps and not conducting business in that manner, then I would say they are not capable of doing the job and should not be doing it.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had discussion with different law enforcement officials as well as public defenders in the state Defense Board, and even though the conversation was a long time ago, there was a growing concern that on the accreditation of laboratories, and it came out of the St. Paul experience. Is there any chance that if we don't get these labs accredited that we may have a problem with prosecution of defendants because we're not getting up to speed?
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Kasbaum?
Madam Chair, members, Senator Limmer, I would say we're already seeing that. It's already happened in Dakota County District Court, where after having a special scientific hearing on the forensic analysis done in a number of drug chemistry cases, cases have had to have been retested or are going to be retested. If generally those results are found to be different by the BCA than St. Paul, those convictions may be thrown out. So it's already happening. And you're correct, it will continue to happen.
Well, my question is then we have a provision in the A2 amendment that extended the time deadline, which seems to be contrary to the desire or the urgency to get these labs that are not accredited, to get them accredited and get them up online. So that's a concern I have with the amendment, and perhaps you're not the one I should be asking that question of. I understand that you're bringing forward a practical discussion that maybe you can't get it done by that time. How do we motivate the labs or the political entities to get this rolling? And get it up to speed? I'm a little concerned about that. I certainly would not want to have some criminal defendant walk because evidence has been tainted or spoiled because it's not being handled correctly or that there's not a full accreditation to the process of how they're analyzing the evidence. I don't think anyone wants that.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, let me suggest, having listened to some of these concerns, an approach. I think this bill becomes effective by, I don't think there's an effective date specific in it right now, so it would have become effective July 1.
August 1.
2013.
Madam Chair, August 1.
August 1. Okay. So what we could do is have a requirement that a lab can provide proof that they've initiated the accreditation process by, say, January 1 of 2014, or they cannot continue to provide evidence for use in prosecution proceedings. And then we have a hard deadline of January 1, 2015, for them to have achieved accreditation. That gives them basically 2.5 years. No, it's a year and a half.
2015.
January 2015. Year and a half. So it might be a little bit short of the time. Maybe we should do, if Mr. Dolor says 2 years.
I think it's possible. Necessary. Madam Chair,
I want to set a hard deadline.
I believe that that would be possible.
I'm just wondering if maybe we should pick a date 2 years out as a hard deadline. So maybe then it's July 1 of 2015. So they've initiated the accreditation process by January 1st of 2014. They've got basically 2 years from the effective date of the legislation then to become accredited or they're out of business.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. And to Mr. Dulles, I think that's heading in the right direction, Senator Latz. And I think then we've got some choices that folks have to make. You're either in the forensic analysis business or you're not. But the confirmation I'm looking for is once that accreditation process is initiated, do the scientists then have peer review and are they expected to follow all the criteria for the accreditation during the process of the evaluation of the accreditation standards?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Dolish might be in a better position to answer that.
Mr. Dolish.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I don't think there's anything in this current language that would mandate that they be operating following those criteria.
Okay.
So I would be looking for some, I guess, to accomplish that, we would have to try to find some language that would capture that idea.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess my Senator question Ortman. Is the accrediting bodies or agencies, they would be reviewing the practices in those crime labs that had initiated an accreditation. Can we expect that?
Once they submit their application, that's part of the process that they would be providing proof that they were following accepted practices.
All right. And then, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Ortman.
I think the amendment is heading in the right direction, Senator Latz. I'm wondering if we want to put some end date on it where it's a two-tiered requirement. You're in the program and you've initiated accreditation, or you must be accredited by a certain date. And that can be pretty far out, like, you know, 2016 would be fine with me. So we know who's in the program, and we can watch what's happening. And then after that, if they've failed the accreditation, they're no longer in business.
Senator Ortman, are you saying then they wouldn't have the opportunity to be accredited later if they weren't accredited during that time period?
Madam Chair, that would not be my intent. My intent would be that they're not operating through unless they've applied or initiated accreditation. What I'm trying to do is close that window, Senator Latz.
Yeah, no, and Madam Chair,
Senator
Ortman, I agree with that. I think the question is what's the best language to accomplish that? And if the language is initiating accreditation or applied for accreditation, proper proof that they're on the path. Applied for. So, Madam Chair, if we had them applying for accreditation and supplying proof of that to the Commissioner of Public Safety by a date certain, say January 1st, 2014.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, could you repeat that,
Senator
Latz?
Ortman.
I'm suggesting that we have proof that they've applied for accreditation by January 1, 2014. That proof will be provided to the Commissioner of Public Safety for posting on the website. And then a deadline of a year and a half after that be fully accredited or they're no longer providing forensic lab services.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I'll ask counsel for help in putting that into the exact language necessary.
We would like to have the counsel tell us. read that off so we all know what it is.
Well, let's take a look.
Madam Chair, I've got a question. Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and members, it's a pretty complicated amendment that I was drafting while you were talking, and I'm not sure it's 100% what you want, but I think it would get you pretty close, and if you wanted to pass the bill based on that, maybe tweak it on the floor, it's up to you. But I was looking at the original bill, Senate File 1269, on page 1, line 22, reinsert the 2014, which was deleted by the amendment. And then after must, insert colon 1, so that all of the language that follows relating to certification, including the new language in the amendment, would be clause 1. And then clause 2 would be on line 2 point, well, actually it would be on the amendment, line 1.5 after the parentheses, the ILAC, it would be a semicolon, or number 2, have begun the formal process of seeking certification under clause 1 and currently are following the standards necessary for certification. So that way, as of January 1, the lab would have to be either certified or have begun the formal process of seeking certification and currently following the standards necessary for certification. Then I was going to suggest on line 2.3, after accreditation, insert or an affirmation that the laboratory is in compliance with clause 2. So that's what would go on the website. It would be either the certificate of accreditation or this affirmation that they're compliant with this other law and they're seeking certification. And then finally, on the amendment A2, that paragraph B, after extend, insert for up to 18 months. And then after that, insert is in compliance with paragraph A, clause 2, if. And then on line 1.9, after determines, insert the laboratory. And then after the period on line 1.9, insert this extension may be made only on one occasion. So I think the combined effect would be that as of January 1, 2014, the lab must be accredited or it must be begun the formal process of seeking certification and is currently following all the standards.
Certification or accreditation?
Accreditation, as such should be the term.
Have begun the formal process of seeking certification.
Mr. Beckett, seeking accreditation, not certification.
That's correct. And they're also following the standards that would result in accreditation. The commissioner then could, for the good cause shown, extend that January 1 deadline for up to 18 months for unaccredited laboratories that are making adequate process towards accreditation, and it's a one-time extension. I think that would get you that would be the final deadline.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Letts, I think I tracked most of that, but I'm not sure about the commissioner part. And I'm wondering if you might be willing to lay the bill on the table so that we work the final language out and get a chance to see it before we move this bill, because I expect that it's going to the Senate floor. And I, because of some of the changes back and forth, I would really appreciate a chance to see it. I think some of the folks that are here would also appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. So I'll ask the chair to lay this bill on the table, and we'll plan on bringing it back yet this week.
Madam Chair, though, I have a question.
Yes.
It's kind of a procedural and practical implications. I know at the county board to like January 1st, 2014 may seem like a long way out, but lots of times there are processes that have to go in step. And so if an organization has been, you know, a city or somebody has been thinking about seeking accreditation, is there enough time to, for, you know, practical purposes, if they need to do some type of study, financial analysis, feasibility study, to decide if they want to do this? Does that give them enough? Or is everybody that's going to get And going for this has already kind of been looking at this, so it's not a six-month window to just figure out should we move forward. So I don't know if that, from a practical standpoint, if this January 14th day, because I don't know what begun the formal process, what that all entails. So if that's just sending a letter that we're thinking about this, or what? How do you define that, and is there enough time to do that by the 14th? So if I'm, I mean, I know Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis went back and forth for several times of doing one, and that, you know, that wasn't a one-month time frame to discuss. So I'm just looking at from a practical standpoint, does that work?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I think it's a fair point. I would hope that a couple of governmental bodies could, within 6 months' time, determine if they wanted to move forward or not. And certainly there would be an incentive here for them to expedite the process if they needed to, balancing that against the need to have confidence in the lab results.
Okay. I'm just throwing that out there.
Senator Latz moves to put Senate file, lay Senate file 1269 on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's yours. It's yours. Are you up?
I just worked off the
Are we done? Even better. Let's go home.
I'll tell them your pensions.
That's in 112.
Okay, so members, we have finished the agenda for tonight. Well, thank you for your work on the last bill, by the way. I think it's helpful. We're going to meet. Our next meeting will be Thursday at noon, and then again at 6 p.m., both here in this room. On Friday, we're going to start at 11:30. It's been previously noticed for 12. We're going to try to get a little bit earlier start anyway, because we got a long agenda, and we have to get them done, because it's deadline day. I know Senator Sharon's going to be chairing her own committee at the same time, so we'll just do our best to manage this time of session. So with that, we are adjourned.